astounded at how accurately Psalm 22 depicts death by crucifixion. And yet, when Psalm 22 was written, death by crucifixion had not yet been invented. Psalm 22 talks about the death of the Messiah. When you come to Psalm 23, you have the great shepherd psalm. And if you'll remember, in the New Testament, when Jesus was here, particularly recorded for us in John's Gospel, he talks about and presents himself as the shepherd, the great shepherd, the good shepherd. In other passages, he talks about himself as being the shepherd who is not content with a 99 percentile. He wants 100%. He is the shepherd who gathers all the sheep together and cares for them and watches for them. He is the good shepherd. And that, I think, is why Psalm 23 gives all of us so much comfort. When grief or conflict or trouble comes into our life, the passage that surfaces in our thinking is the 23rd Psalm. We're always encouraged to be reminded afresh that it is, after all, the living God, through his Son, Jesus Christ, who is our shepherd. His rod and his staff comfort us. He leads us beside the still waters. He restores our souls. He is going to go through with us the very valley of the shadow of death. He is going to prepare for us a place in the presence of our enemies. That is such a comforting passage, such a comforting psalm. And that is the way Jesus is today. That is the way we are to experience him today. He is our shepherd. I can't remember in 16 years of ministry, perhaps I've done it, but I can't remember if I did it. That may be senility, huh? But I can't remember having preached or participated in a funeral where we did not use the 23rd Psalm. And it's not because people don't know the Psalm. In fact, when you ask even people that are, when I've done funerals for strangers, and I've asked people to recite with me the 23rd Psalm, you just hear this unison of voices lifting up the words of that great psalm by David. Not that they don't know it. It's that it's the repeating of it is a reassurance that this is from God. But that is our experience of him as the shepherd. When you come to Psalm 24, Psalm 24 looks into the future. It is the Messiah who is coming. It is the king who will take up his rightful place as ruler on this planet. So if you take these three psalms in sequence, what you have is Psalm 22 looking past at the death of Christ, what has already happened. Psalm 23 describes our experience of the Lord today as our shepherd, as the one who comforts us. And Psalm 24 looks at the Messiah as the king, the one who is yet to come in his power and his glory to rule as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So we have a look into the past, an expression of the present, and a look towards the future. Three great psalms about the Messiah. We're going to look, as I mentioned, specifically at Psalm 24. It is a psalm of celebration. It is a psalm which remembers God in a day when people were not concerned about God. One of the most fascinating things about Psalm 24 is that it is written in a day and in a time when people's love for God had cooled. They were no longer fired in their imagination and in their devotion to the Lord. Psalm 24 emerges against that backdrop. As a matter of fact, I think if you study carefully the history of Israel, you will discover that it was not characteristic for the common people to really have a great deal of enthusiasm and devotion to God. At the very time that Moses was receiving that tremendous revelation from God on Mount Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments and the description of how the tabernacle would be built and the sacrifices should be offered. The people were at the base of the mountain, creating a golden calf and preparing to worship it. It's not the same kind of devotion. Even when the people had gotten into the wilderness and God was providing day by day, daily bread, the manna, they were complaining about the food. Even when the Levites took the ark and they preceded the entire army of Israel right across the Jordan River, watched it dry up, and they proceeded to Jericho and marched around it and took that city by doing no more than blowing their trumpets and surrounding that city in the marching fashion. Watch the walls crumble. Nevertheless, it is Joshua who has to challenge the people again. Choose you this day whom you will serve. The period of Judges is one of the dark periods in the life of Israel. Time and time and time again, you read the sad cycle of the people's departure from the worship of Jehovah. Again and again and again, they succumb to the worshiping of the idols, to the pressure of the society around them. And time again, God raises up a judge. He leads them out of bondage. He releases them from the Philistines or the Canaanites or some other tribe that was there in that area and rallies them around again to the cause of God. But it was not the common practice of the people to follow God. It's interesting that this psalm remembers very specifically and commemorates the movement of the ark from Gibeon up to Mount Zion. That's the celebration that we're going to look at. David is so excited because the ark is going to come to Mount Zion. And he's trying to fire up the enthusiasm of the people for this tremendous event as they bring it to his home city, the city that he conquered and will establish as Jerusalem. The people had forgotten about the significance of the ark. They had neglected it. Some had even abused it. If you read the history of what happened to this great ark of God, the instrument within the tabernacle that symbolized God's presence with his people, all kinds of bizarre things happened. It was, of course, first taken to Gilgal, which is recorded for us in Joshua, and later taken up to Shiloh. And Shiloh is where we read the stories about Eli and Samuel. That's where the ark is. It's not in Jerusalem. It's in Shiloh, and that's where Eli is, the great high priest, and Samuel becomes anointed there. They moved the ark for a very brief time down to Bethel because there was a war going on and they were afraid it was going to be captured. But then a very terrible thing happens with the sons of Eli. They're losing a battle and they against the Philistines, and they decide that somehow if they can rally the magic of God on their side, they can defeat the Philistines. And they go and they take the ark and they take it into battle, and the ark is captured by the Philistines and taken to their home. That's one of the saddest things I can imagine. To assume that somehow by rubbing the ark or presenting the ark or in some way they could garner up the magic of God to do what they themselves needed to do. But if that's one of the saddest stories, the next one is the funniest. I have to tell you that I just die laughing every time I read about the ark being in Ashdod and in Ekron with the Philistines. These people had created a temple, and they put an idol in this temple, and that was the god to whom they worshiped. And they were very sincere and very devout about that god. And so they brought in the ark, and it would show that their god was superior to this god, and this god would be an homage to their god. But every day when they came in, their God had his face in the dirt. God just, you know, walked over, I'm sure, and just stopped it over. You know, and I'm sure these sincere, devout Philistines came in and just were, what have you done? God's got his face in the dirt. And pick the idol up and dust it off and reestablish it and do all the things that they would have to do to make sure that they hadn't offended that God. And it's one of the most amusing accounts that you can ever read. It's really funny. Pretty soon, though, a plague breaks out on the people of Philistia, and it's so intense that they finally come to their senses and realize that it is the glory of God, the ark of God, that has brought this plague. And now they've got to divest themselves of it, but how do you get rid of it? And so they try to figure out a method or a plan to get rid of this ark, and they ultimately put it on a little cart without a driver and two oxen. And these two oxen take off, guided by the hand of the Lord, back to the nation of Israel. It ends up in Beth-Shemesh for a while, and some of the people treated it irreverently there. Some of the guys said, golly, that's the first time I've ever seen an ark. I think I'm just looking sad. And 70 of them died like that. They really weren't devout. They really weren't concerned about God. They just idle curiosity. Oh, that's a neat thing. From Beth-Shemesh it was taken to Kiriath-Jearim and ultimately to Gibeon, where Saul called for it and established it there. But in the meantime, it had been separated from the tabernacle. No longer was the great brazen altar and the great bronze laver in front of it. No longer was the golden altar there, or the table of showbread, or the golden candlestick. None of that was there. It had been defiled and taken away, and it was in a separate place in the tabernacle, and things had fallen into a shambles. And there was not among the common people a care and a concern for the things of God. It's against this pitiful backdrop of unconcern that you have this great psalm. This fantastic psalm which excites your imagination and fires our enthusiasm for the coming of the King of Glory. David had built a little tent on Mount Zion, and he intended to bring that ark up and to capture everybody's imagination. Now you have to remember that David was a man who was out of step with his contemporaries. He was a man who was unique and unusual. He was not like the commoners of Israel. He was a man who had a desire for God. He loved God. In fact, in the Bible, the only time the phrase "a man after God's own heart" is used is to describe David. He loved God more than anything else. His constant concern was for God. And he had built this tent, and he was going to bring the ark up, and I am sure he wanted to rekindle the nation's devotion to God. He had been grieved by the fact that God was held in such low esteem generally, and he desired to exalt God above himself by building a house for God. That was really his ultimate intent. When he brought that ark from Gibeon up to Mount Zion, he really had intended to build a house, a glorious house for God. Now, the nation, or the place that he brought it up on Mount Zion, of course, is the present location of Jerusalem. But the city that you see today is much larger than the little city that David had established on Mount Zion. As a matter of fact, he had just captured the Jebusite city there, and it was a very small place, probably only contained hundreds of families, certainly not thousands of families. It was a very tiny kind of walled city. And Jerusalem itself sits on a hogback, and it runs north and south. And it always bothered me, as I studied topo maps of Jerusalem and the area, why they established the early city down on Mount Zion, when back up the hill a little way is another knoll called Mount Moriah, where currently the Muslim Mosque of Omar is. And that was the place where the temple was built. And it bothered me. I never could understand why you would build it down on Mount Zion, when that's the kind of the farthest little pinnacle out on the edge of this little hogback. And I don't know a lot about military strategy, but I know if you can get to high ground, you got a better chance of defending it. I've played King on the Mountain enough times to know if you can get on the top, it's easier to push guys down the hill than it is try to climb up the hill. So I figured the best place is to get as high ground as you could. So why build the city down on Mount Zion? But when we visited Jerusalem last year, I discovered why. There's a water supply called the Gihon Spring that comes out right at the base of that mountain right there by Mount Zion. And therefore, they built that little city around a place where they could get water when they were experiencing times of siege. And it wasn't until Hezekiah's time that they diverted the Gihon spring in such a way that it came inside the walls, and they began to enlarge the walls and make the city much larger. So it is David, though, that brings the ark up to this little tiny knoll out on this hogback, and he's going to put it there, but his intent always is to build a house for God. That's what he wants to do. Now, God had told him that he was not going to allow David to do that. And I think it really discouraged David. I think he was, it's kind of a thing that you have in your mind, a desire, a dream, or something that you want to do so badly that God had forbidden to do it. And so he does the next best thing. And you ought to read it sometime to see, it's kind of like watching a child. Have you ever watched a child when you say, do not stick your finger in the sugar? You ever said that? Do not stick your finger in the sugar. So they run their finger around the edge of the sugar bowl, and they climb up on top and look down in it. They do everything they possibly can do except the very thing that you told them. You cannot do this one thing. You cannot stick your finger in it. Okay? And they pick it up and they look at it. They just do everything you can imagine. That's what David was doing. He says, I can't build a house for God, but I can get it ready. I can get it all ready. And Solomon, and I know Solomon's a young man, and he's going to be inexperienced, and therefore I really need to help him. And so he set out the people to cut the great timbers and stonemasons to go to the rock quarries and cut just exactly the right size of rock, and to begin to collect the gold and the bronze and the silver into the treasury so that everything would be exactly ready and get the plan designed so that he would know exactly what was going to happen. And even though he couldn't get his fingers on it to do it, he could have everything ready to go. It gives you a little bit of a feeling of what David was like. He loved God. He loved God. He wanted to build this house. And he's going to create for us an image of a special time as he rekindles the imagination of Israel when they bring the ark from Gibeon up to Mount Zion. As he thinks about not only that occasion, but a greater occasion, a time when the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords would come into his city and assume his rightful place as the King of Glory. It's always amazing to me about David. He was a man who did not esteem himself very highly. Did not look at his own ability. Probably if you were to look back at the life of David, you would have to say that he and Moses are probably number one and two, and you might argue over which one is one and which one is two, preeminent theologians from the Old Testament. Outstanding and incredible thinkers. He was probably one of the greatest military strategists of his day. He was a man of tremendous strength and courage. Did not back down from a fight. He was a man who was so strong and so courageous that he rallied around him what the scriptures talk about as David's mighty men. Strong men who were fearless in battle. And they took on many times more than their numbers and were able to defeat them because of their strength and because of their courage. That was the kind of a man that he was. Charismatic leader of his people. But he was a man who had a heart. He was a man who wrote poetry. The 23rd Psalm, maybe the most preeminent piece of poetry ever written by anybody, at any time. Not to mention the other Psalms that he wrote. He's a musician. A man who set things to music. A man who was able to fill the troubled soul of Saul by his music. What a tremendous individual. You look back at his abilities. A planner, a thinker, a leader, a follower of God. But when it comes to this psalm, it is not himself that he is impressed with. It is the ultimate remembering, that God is going to come. The King of Glory is going to come to Jerusalem. He's going to reign as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he is so excited that he writes this psalm to fire people's imagination. Let's look at it. Psalm 24. Not really a very long psalm, but I think it helps to understand the backdrop from which it comes. David begins. The earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. Who may ascend unto the hill of the Lord, and who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart. He has not lifted up his soul to falsehood, and has not sworn deceitfully. He shall receive a blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is the generation of those who seek him, who seek thy faith, even Jacob. Lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. He is the King of Glory, the Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O gates, and lift them up, O ancient doors, that the King of Glory may come in. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. The psalm basically falls into two parts. If you want to study it analytically, verses 1 to 6 form the first part, verses 7 to 10 form the second part. Each of those two parts has three main thoughts running through it. In the first part, we look at God, and we see him in verses 1 and 2 as God the Almighty. In verses 3 and 4 as God the Most Holy. In verses 5 and 6 as God the Incredibly Merciful. When you come to the last part, it is a repetition of thoughts. The announcement is made that the King is coming. The true identity of the king is questioned, and then the king is identified as Jehovah himself. So each of these two sections has three parts to it. Let's look, first of all, at the first section. The first stanza, verses 1 and 2, establishes Jehovah's rightful ownership of the world and its inhabitants by virtue of creation. It is God who is the creator of the world. He has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. The astounding thing about verses 1 and 2 is that David does not describe God as being some kind of local deity. Time and time again, when you read the literature of that era, you will find this God representing this people, and he would fight for those people, and this another God representing another people, and he would fight for those people. And basically, the way people thought about it was, we will know if our God is stronger by whether or not we can defeat you in battle. But you would never suppose that those other people would accept your God. I mean, he was your God. He was a local deity. He reigned in your area, in your territory. And the more powerful he got, the more expanded your territory was. That's not David's concept. Although there are many Bible critics who try to say that is how Jehovah is depicted in the Old Testament. That is not so. Jehovah is not a local deity. Notice what David said. The earth is the Lord's and all it contains. The world. So the first thing we notice is that the God that David's talking about is not some local deity, but neither is he some ethnic deity. He is not just a God of the Jews. He is not just a God of the Arabs. He is not just a God of the Chinese. He is not just a God of the Americans. He is a God of all the inhabitants. Some people don't really appreciate that perspective. They don't really think that God really is the owner of this planet. But he is, whether they acknowledge it or not. And one day they're going to be faced with the same dilemma that people were challenged to face a number of years ago, where I can remember people saying, America, love it or leave it. Remember people saying that? There was some bumper stickers and things like that. It's kind of an attitude that we have. If you don't like it here, find someplace else to live. And that may be the same kind of dilemma that people are going to be faced with when God comes back to take what's his. You know, they may not like that. Fine. Find someplace else to live. It's going to be a real dilemma. One man in trying to paint a picture of what David is describing here talks about people not really knowing what to do with the treasures that they have when God comes back. I have a little dog at home. I maintain that she's defective mentally. The family resents that, but I think there's just cause. This little dog loves table food. Now, she will eat the udder out of desperation after a 2 or 3 day fast to make her point with us, but she loves table food, and what she really likes are little steak bones. Those are her just absolute all-time favorite. The problem is that you cannot eat an entire steak bone all at once. I'm not even sure you can eat a whole steak bone anyway. And so what this little dog does is she carries this poor little bone around in her mouth. And she does not like to put it down. But she doesn't want to eat it either. And she's got this most pathetic little whine. And you know when she's got a steak bone. Somebody's given her a steak bone. She walks around. You hear this whining, and it's the saddest thing you ever heard in your life. She doesn't want to put it down, and she knows she can't eat it, and she's just caught in a terrible dilemma. Isn't that the way the people of this world are going to be, who have laid up for themselves treasures upon this earth? What are they going to do when the great catastrophe hits? When Jehovah comes back to take what is his? Gather it up and hold on to it. Walk around with it. You can't eat it, and you can't put it down, and you can't take it with you. Can you imagine what a terrible, terrible dilemma they will face? Not their sister. We realize that God has described us as stewards only. We're bond slaves. We're allowed to only use what is here, just to use it for his glory, and then to return it to him. It belongs to him. It is not ours to hold on to. The earth is the Lord's, and all that is in it, and all of its inhabitants, whether they like it or whether they don't. But stranger too comes. Who then can stand in the hill of the Lord? And who may stand in his holy place? When this great God, who is the creator of all, returns, who will be able to stand there? And the psalmist replies, he who has clean hands. On the basis of this verse, I am convinced that no junior high boys will ever get into the kingdom. I wish you sometimes could see what they eat out of on a camp out. But you're about ready for lunch, and I won't go into that. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, and who's not lifted up his soul to falsehood. What the psalmist is trying to describe is that the person who must stand in the presence of God is one whose actions are pure. One whose heart and intentions are not grievous. One whose words are true and not deceitful. Which one of us can stand there in his presence? There is not enough detergent in the world to wash us clean. But we can be cleansed. Isn't it John who tells us in his first epistle, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness? Is that not what we need to stand in his presence? We come before God, and brothers and sisters, we must come with open hands. We must confess what we have done that is wrong. Are you honest with yourself and with God about your sin, so that you can be cleansed? That's what he provides. We can't be perfect, but we can be forgiven, so that we too can stand on that holy hill, in that special place where God is. The question also comes up, and it's an unasked question, by the way, between 4 and 5.
But if you get to verse 4 and you see a shift and you come to verse 5, say, well, that doesn't follow in a line of thought. It's because there's an unasked question. The unasked question in verse at the end of verse 4 is, who wants to go there anyway? Who wants to go into the presence of God? If I know that he's going to be on Mount Zion, maybe I'll just check out of his own busy. Then I won't have to face there. Who wants to go to the presence of God? David replied, the one who will receive a blessing from God and righteousness from the God of his salvation. It's those people who want to seek God. Those people who love God, who really want God, who literally lust after righteousness. Those are the people that want to go, and they need to know how to get there. And so in this great psalm, as he begins to fire the imagination of the people and to remind them that the God that they worship is the God of the earth. He is the God of creation. He is the God of all people, not just the Jewish people alone. And that if they will stand in his presence, they must be clean and clean from their sin. And that those are the people who are seeking the Lord. And now he prepares them for the time that the ark itself will begin to come up the mountain as it begins to enter this little town, this Jebusite city that David has conquered, ultimately to be called Jerusalem. The picture that we get in verses 7 to 10 is twofold. First of all, it is like a Disney animation. The psalmist is describing the inanimate object of a city. The gates. The ancient doors. And he addresses those gates and those ancient doors, and he says, gates and doors, you better get ready. Now, if the inanimate object has to get ready, how is a gate or a door ever going to get ready? You ever wondered about that? But he's trying again to capture the imagination. It's as though that city itself, the very stones and the timbers in it, recognize that this is not just some ordinary king. This is the King of Glory. The picture is given, ultimately, of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords who will return to Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem is a pathetic, dirty little city. It really is. It's just a little fuzzy city sitting out on top of a knoll, and we have all sentimentalized it. And you go to Jerusalem and you have this tremendous feeling, not because of what you're looking at, but because of what you know it stands for. This fuzzy, dirty little Middle Eastern city is one day going to house the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Can you imagine when the King of Glory returns to this earth, when the heavens are parted, when he, as the King of Glory, marshals all of the heavenly hosts, all of the saints of the angels in battle array, and he stands before the eastern gates there in Jerusalem? Oh boy, the gates better get ready. They're not big enough to take in this great King of Glory. They need to paint themselves. They need to polish all the brass. They need to suck all the trash off of the seats. They need to get ready because the kingdom is coming. What a limit. That's what David wanted to fire in the imagination of the people. To remind them that this great opportunity was coming their way. That this, what they were doing in bringing the ark up from Gibeah up to Zion, was just a symbol of what it was going to be like in the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords returns. Oh, Kate, you better get ready. You better spread out. You won't hardly be able to continue. The second thing that we get is a repetition. Now, David is not so silly as to believe that he didn't get the point the first time. But what it reminds me of is what happens with children in Vacation Bible School. Now, many of you don't come to Vacation Bible School. Probably you need to, but you don't, for whatever reason. But the kids and I and the teachers get together in this room right here during Vacation Bible School, and we sort of have a ritual that we go through. They sing, they're opening song, and then they have their pledges, and then I take the microphone and I say, "Good morning, children." We get to about six voices respond, "Good morning." And so I repeat it. I say, "Good morning, children." Because the next response blows my ears off. It was like a fearless. Will you hear it the first time? Will I hear it the second time? Are you ready, oh God? Are you ready? Then it is the King of Glory, who is the Lord, the strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. Oh, lift him up again, Jim. The King of Glory. Who is the King of Glory? He is our Lord of hosts. He is the King of Glory. And so we have those two things that stand out to us as we look at this last part of the psalm. Even though we didn't have an object to be getting ready for the coming of the King. Not to mention that. That's essential. And so we have the King of Glory to whom he was identified as the Messiah. Time and time again through the Old Testament, the killing is identified as Jehovah. The Messiah is described as Jehovah. It should come as no surprise to the Christian or the serious Bible student that any person who would call himself off as the Messiah of Israel must persuade people that he is also the living God. Because the entire Old Testament is replete with one evidence and one statement after another that he is God. The King is God. The Messiah is God. The one we look forward to is God himself. He is the King of Glory, Jehovah of hosts, the one and the Son. And so when Jesus comes in the New Testament and he says, "I and the Father are one," it is merely a fulfillment of what the Old Testament predicted would be true. No other person fits those qualifications. No other great world leader has ever tried to persuade people that he was God. Only fools have tried to persuade people that he was God. Jesus pulled it off. You're not impressed with me as the scriptures. That there were hundreds and thousands of people who were willing to die because they said, "Yeah, he is God. He really is God." Now, you know, you might palm that off on a group of children. You might palm that off on a group of adults. You've lived a while, walked on this earth, watched your friends, watched their family. You can say that this person is God. What he did, Jesus walked in our midst and persuaded person after person that he himself was the living God, the Jehovah of all. Psalm 22 looks at Psalm 23 looks at the present, but Psalm 24 looks at the future. It seems to me that you and I also are in a similar position to David. David wanted so much to build a house for God. He did everything, got everything ready. Created an opportunity to fire people's imaginations. You read about this in the Old Testament of when they brought the ark up. I mean, they had this great parade, this great processional, and all the instruments are playing, and the choruses are singing, and the artists are shooting, and David's out in front playing, and singing, and dancing. And boy, it's a great festive occasion, because he wants people to be fired up about God. Not just that moment in history. David was no fool. He looked forward not to his own kingship, and his own identity as the King of Israel, which he was legitimately, but ultimately to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords who would come, the King of Hosts, the King of Glory. That's what he wanted. So their devotion, their commitment, their faith and trust in God would be enriched and expanded, and they would be encouraged to follow. Are we not close to that together? Do we not need to be doing that for each other? Firing up each other's imagination about what we can do today to capture people's imagination for God. What can we do to make the ministry at Metropolitan Baptist Church better? You ever talk about that with your friends and brothers and sisters? You ever talk among yourself? What can you and I do to make the early childhood area, or the media center, or the music ministry, or the vacation Bible schools, or the day camp, or whatever? What can we do to make this even better for God? How can we fire the imagination of people to do that? And not just for here, but for all the ministries in our community. For the Child Evangelism Fellowship, for the Bible Fellowship, for the Gideon, for the Campus Crusades for Christ. What can we do to capture the people of God's imagination so they don't drift off like the people of Israel did and neglect and abuse their walk with the Lord? What can we do to talk among ourselves so that the ministry becomes greater, so that we give people opportunity to worship and to care for God and His work today as we all look forward to His coming? I think it is important for us to stir one another, to not allow each other to become careless in our walk, but to be concerned about greater faith and greater work for the Lord as we work for the King of Glory. Dear Father, thank you for David. Thank you for his life for you. Cause his excitement to rub off on us so that we too might be committed as we run. In Jesus' name we ask it. Amen. You are dismissed.